You're listening to the Drummers Education Connection Podcast. Interviews with the greatest drummers in the business and roundtable discussions with industry leaders and teachers from around the globe to help provide performance, insight, and inspiration. Welcome to Drummers Education Connection. How you guys doing? I'm Bart Robley. I'm here with my friend Chip Ritter and our esteemed guest from the Billy Idol band, Eric Aldeñas, down below. Esteemed. Eric, welcome to the show.
Esteemed.
Wow, I've been called
what? Yeah, I've been called way worse than that. Chip didn't know I knew a big vocabulary word like esteemed.
Yeah, that was two syllables. You're working your way up.
I'm working on it, man. I'm working
I'm
on it.
Google that real quick to see what it means. I don't know what that definition is.
Me too. Anyway, everybody, welcome to DEC. It's great to be here. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. And if you're listening to this after the fact, thank you guys so much for watching us and contributing to the show. If you want to contribute to the show and keep the lights on, help us out, you can go to Patreon. And any donation there is always going to go to our website. Go to stuff for DEC Day when we have our DEC Day event, which is going to be the next one is going to be in April at the Aquarian Drumhead Factory. And as usual, we want to start with a good thing. So I'm going to throw it over to my buddy Chip in Tucson. Chip, how are you? What do you got going
on? I'm doing great. Now, let me first say thank you, Eric, for coming on. We really appreciate it, man.
This
is cool. I'm excited about this. What's that?
Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for being here, man. My good thing, Bart and Eric, I have a symbol. A student of mine, 11-year-old Alan, this female student of mine, cracked her symbol, and she autographed it to me and wrote all over it, like, best drum teacher ever, and you make me laugh and smile and stuff like that. So I'm feeling, like, overjoyed with gratitude over that. It's just, like, a really cool thing. It's the bee's knees. How about you, Bart? What's good?
Oh, man, that's great. You know what? Everything's awesome, man. Just got back from a kind of a one-off that we went out and played in Phoenix this weekend, so that went good. And I'm happy to say I've been getting some reviews back on my Bullseye one-shots. And a couple of producers have bought my one shots, and some guys that make loops have bought some of my one shots, and they're really digging them. They love the sounds. They're using them. They're making them to some people who do programming. One shots are making out their way out into the world. So I'm excited about that, and that's going good. Eric, what's happening good with you, buddy? What good thing do you have going on?
We had our first day of snow.
Nice.
Awesome.
And nice. I have a wife that still likes me.
Nice.
You're a lucky man.
It doesn't get better than that.
It's the simple things, guys. It's the simple things.
It always is.
No, I'm all joking aside. I have a job, which is fantastic. I have a studio that is really comfortable. So super grateful about that.
That's great. Well, for those of you guys who are tuning in, Eric plays for Billy Idol, and we're going to pick his brain about that. And he owns a recording studio up in Pine Mountain, California, which until this morning, I didn't know where Pine Mountain was. And it's called Pine Mountain Recording Studios, right?
The studio is called Twin Pines Recording.
Twin Pines Recording.
Part of that is an homage to my absolute biggest influence, which is David Lynch and his TV show Twin Peaks.
Nice. Oh, nice. Very cool. So let's jump in
Bart. TwinPinesRecording.com, just for our listeners on Spotify. TwinPinesRecording.com. Check them out.
That's awesome. Now, you said your biggest influence is?
David Lynch, filmmaker.
Let's jump in there. We're going to jump around. We'll go back to Billy Idol in a minute. How did he become your biggest influence? Explain. I'm very intrigued with that.
Wow. Well, that's a little difficult to answer, I guess. It's just all of his movies have just spoken to me a certain way, and not just in the way that he writes and directs. Everything from, you know, the cinematography, the visual impression, and also sound. Like, he's very obsessed with music and sound.
Yeah.
And so the way all of that sort of comes together, like, I always, it's going to sound silly, but I kind of feel like I want to live in his movies.
Yeah.
So when I found Pine Mountain, when I first drove into our little mountain village, it actually looked like the opening scene of Twin Peaks. And I just had this feeling of like, wow, I'm home. Like, I found it, you know? So I know it sounds silly, but yeah, I want to live in a David Lynch movie. So I have done the best that I can in order to achieve that, you know, without being in one of his movies. So
that's awesome.
That's incredible. Now, you said that the this is in the Los Angeles. Explain to us where it's at. Explain to us geographically where you are in comparison to Studio City, because that's where you said you lived for quite some time.
Yeah. So Pine Mountain is located right in the middle of the Los Padres National Forest.
Okay.
So if maybe people are more aware of places like Ojai.
Right.
So you, on a map, it kind of just looks like you're just north of there, but it's a little trickier to get to because you have to go through all these windy roads. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's up there, and it's clean, peaceful, quiet. You know, I wake up to the sound of birds and watch, you know, mountain ranges and pine trees.
That's tremendous, man. That is cool. Absolutely. That's really cool. That's really cool. Okay, yeah. So let's go back to how did this whole drumming journey for you start? We'll get to Billy Idol in a minute, but how did the drumming journey start for you?
Oh, it's probably pretty typical, you know, finding out early on that you liked, you know, to drum on pots and pans around the kitchen. Breaking lots of cookingware and chopsticks, things like that. And then eventually, my parents were kind enough to get me some drums, and I was around 4 at the time.
Okay.
And
they gave you real drums, right?
Yeah,
real drum set. I heard that in an interview you did. That's awesome.
Ludwig drums, like a big 24-inch bass drum. Like, I was literally standing up playing. but this is super important. Aside from just having super supportive parents, like, you have to have a basement.
You know? Yes.
Yeah. And so no plan B.
That's right. A basement. You've watched it.
Those are the two things. Yeah.
A basement. Good parents and no plan B. Yeah, for sure.
Nice.
I write for, I've been a writer for many years. I've written for a lot of different trade magazines and whatnot. I have an article up on Medium. If you ever read Medium articles, but I have an article called Fuck Plan B. Excuse my language, but it totally is. It's about that. It's about, no, there's no plan B. There's no, just go that way, and anything that gets in your way, knock it out of the way. Go over it, around it, through it, under it, dynamite, whatever you got to do. Just keep going that way if you love something, you know. So that's really
cool. It's just I just feel like it's such a blessing to, from an early age, mm-hmm. to find a passion that you want to just go for.
Yeah.
And just think about how many people we know that, I mean, maybe even to this day, don't necessarily have that strong of a, I hate to call it purpose in life, but
right.
I remember specifically the day I graduated from high school, most of my classmates were petrified.
Mm-hmm.
because they had no idea what they were going to do. Like, now what? And I was like, I'm moving to Los Angeles. You know, I know exactly what I'm doing. Yeah. And I don't mean to, you know, sound silly by saying that, but I mean, I mean, I guess I feel incredibly grateful just to even just to have that, to know what I wanted to go for.
Yeah.
And that, you know, also for my parents, I think, you know, imagine, you know, your child, even though it's maybe considered a bit of a wild idea, like, hey, you know, I grew up in Sweden, I'm going to move to Los Angeles. You know, again, supportive parents. But at the same time, I would imagine if you're a parent and your child has a very strong pull towards something and a passion and maybe sort of proven that this could actually work out as a lifestyle, kind of makes their job a lot easier. Like, all right, we could maybe check Eric off the list in terms of, you know, concerns.
Right.
Immediate concerns, should I say.
So you grew up in Sweden, and were you born there, or did you?
I was actually born in India.
In India, okay.
Yeah, my Swedish parents adopted me when I was just a couple of months old.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
So, yeah,
that's awesome. My dad married my stepmom and adopted my sister. And
wait a minute. Your dad married your
stepmom. Dad got married, and my stepmom had a daughter, and my dad adopted my sister. And my sister and I are really close. And my sister, about 6 years ago now, adopted two beautiful little girls. And so that's something that's really cool and really near and dear to my heart. So that's really cool. So you just knew Sweden, you know, that's where you grew up. And so you went from there to LA.
Yep. That's what I ended up doing. You know, my plan was actually to move to New York City, be a jazz drummer.
Okay.
And then something went horribly wrong. I moved to LA and joined a rock band.
So going from Sweden to LA, that must have been like, you know, moving to Mars, you know, when you first got there, you know?
I was lucky in the sense, my dad took me to New York City when I was 13 years old, and I was just like sold on the whole idea of just moving to the U.S. in general. And of course, it furthered my ambition and desire, you know, to, you know, come here and pursue music.
Right.
But then I was lucky 2 years before I moved here to Los Angeles, I was able to come here on vacation and kind of spend a month just, you know, kind of just scope out what the city is like. And, you know, definitely went and saw a lot of live music just to kind of get an idea of what the music scene was like. So
what year was that?
What
year was that?
I moved here in 97. I first came here in 95 after graduating high school, just to sort of, like I said, you know, and it was also probably a very sort of appeasing thing for my parents to know that, okay, at least, you know, he's been to this place before sort of committing to moving there full time. So,
yeah.
Right on. Eric, so you're in LA and you're chasing your dreams. You're becoming a drummer. You're doing your thing. So how does that lead us up to the Billy Idol gig? How did that happen? Like, what were the steps that you took, the stepping stones that you were on as far as your path?
Well, like most people, you know, you come to this, you know, brand new city and you just try to go out and meet people and try to, you know, build up your connections. I was lucky in the sense that I had found a person named Barry Squire, who used to work for Columbia Records.
Yeah,
so you know him. I
know of him, and I know his stories. I know, yes. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, he, so at some point, I think he was an A&R person, and during that time, he started getting calls from, you know, management companies, labels, to help put together touring bands for new artists, or, you know, it could be established artists, could be new artists. I ended up connecting with him and luckily was able to land a bunch of auditions for touring bands. And so I kind of got started with that pretty early on. And along with that, I was always interested in becoming a studio musician. So I was lucky enough to get those jobs as well in between tours. And on one of the jobs that I had gotten through Barry, I met an artist named Nick Frost. Got the gig with him. His producer happened to be Keith Forsey, who, of course, produced all the early Billy Idol records up until, you know, mid-90s or so. Okay. And so I got along really well with Keith and sort of became sort of his drummer in terms of, you know, anything that he was recording. So one day he just sort of casually asks me that, like, hey, I'm going into the studio with Billy next week. Do you want to come and record? And I was maybe like 23 or 24 at the time. And I met Billy for the first time, and it was an incredible experience. Of course, I was nervous as hell. Mm-hmm. But then, that stuff that we recorded was never released. I mean, Billy had just, I guess, I don't know if he had taken a break or something, but he was kind of coming back into, you know, writing a lot of new music. So a lot of the stuff that I would get called in to do were, you know, they were just demos. But I would get this call like every other year or so from Keith. And he's like, hey, yeah, we're, you know, going to, you know, try a few, you know, new Billy Idol tracks. And I would periodically get called in. And like I said, I was pretty young at the time. And yeah, it wasn't until I think 2010 I got called into, they were going to re-record Rebel Yell and Dancing With Myself. And it had to kind of sound exactly like the original recordings. And I did that. And then I was working with Steve Stevens and Harold Faltermeyer on, Harold is the one that wrote the theme for Top Gun and Beverly Hills Cop and all that stuff. You know,
that's cool. Incredible
composer. And so they were doing another sort of majestic piece like the Top Gun theme, but for something else. And so that's sort of the first time I got to work with Steve. And all of those things sort of kind of, you know, happened during 2010, 2011, something like that. And then 2012, I guess they needed a new drummer. And I think because of everything that sort of been leading up to that point, and obviously with a strong recommendation from Keith Forsey, it just sort of made, I guess it made sense. And it wasn't like, it was an audition, but it felt more like a rehearsal. You know, I prepared a lot of songs and, you know, like this was definitely a job that I had been wanting for a long time. And so I had sort of in the back of my mind somewhere, like maybe, you know, one day this opportunity will come. So I had, you know, prepared a lot. Like I knew a lot of the songs already and it's all, you know, physically, it's a very demanding situation. Like it's, you know, a lot of fast tempos, you know, it's a lot of hard hitting. So I'd sort of kind of prepared myself that maybe one day this will happen. And luckily it did.
That's awesome. About hitting hard, I've seen the drum kit tour from Modern Drummer's YouTube video. And you have Eric has a sandbag that he puts on the bottom of the snare stand. That's how hard he hits the drum, dude. Otherwise, it walks away from him. that's pretty hard,
it,
man.
It comes at me. It wants to attack me. You know, it's payback for, you know, hitting it. It's like, well, motherfucker, I'm going to hit you back.
You're beating it like it owes you money.
Exactly, man. Exactly.
So, Eric, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Chip.
I was just going to say, recently you were in Dallas at the Breast Cancer Can Stick It Drumathon, and you guys got up there and played with Greg Bissonette and did Down Under, and you did your own songs. And I mean, it was really great meeting you and hanging out and watching you play. I was inspired. And I wanted to ask
you. Thank you. Likewise.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you, how did you end up hooking up with April Samuels? How did that happen?
If I remember correctly, we were on tour and her band was doing a show nearby, and she invited me. She just reached out on Facebook or something and invited me to her show. I wasn't unfortunately able to attend because we're leaving right after our show. But then we stayed in touch, and she invited me onto her podcast.
The Beat, early, yeah.
Yeah, maybe it was like about 6 months ago or so. And at the time, she had mentioned the benefit, and I wasn't sure if I was going to be available or not. And then she reached out again, and it just so happened that, you know, I was able to, you know, be part of it, which was great.
Well, that was really cool of you to do that for them. What a great cause. Well, a bunch of good people over there.
Wonderful cause. Yeah. No, it's just really, really, you know, amazing to be part of it.
Right on.
You said a couple of things, Eric, that kind of piqued my ears. I have a couple of questions for you. On the re-record of Rebel Yell and Dancing With Myself, I've had the great opportunity to work with Michael Blum. Do you know who he is? Producer in Studio City. He did like Madonna's Like a Prayer. He did a lot of Suicidal Tendency stuff.
And I've worked with Mike a lot.
You know Mike?
Yes.
Do you really?
Mm-hmm. Does he still have the place right there by Ventura Boulevard?
He still has it, but it's rented out. He's not recording there anymore.
Okay. He's,
yeah, but yeah, that's where I've done a ton. I've worked there with him a lot, and we did a lot of re-records for sync licensing.
And I remember when he started doing that.
Yeah, and I've done a ton of that work. I was so grateful for that. And anyway, when we did all the sync licensing stuff, I transcribed everything, note perfect, and then went in and cut to click. No other musicians. I just read down the transcriptions, right? And then they built the tracks on top of me. Now, the reason I'm telling you my story is because when you said you had to re-record the two Billy Idol tracks, and it's not a re-record for sync licensing or something else. It's for the artist. It's for Billy Idol. Did you do that? And how close is the re-record? How close did you have to get? Did you do something like that? I'm really curious.
So I'll give you the quick backstory. I got a call like really early in the morning from Keith, basically just saying, how quickly can you be at the Jungle Room? And now that's a recording studio where a lot of Billy's recording took place. And that's another studio that I happened to, I'd sort of become the, like the house drummer almost, with Brian Reeves, who was the house engineer and owner. And so it was in Glendale. And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, how quickly, what's going on? Like, get out of bed, because he could tell that I had just woken up.
Get out of bed.
Get in the car, have coffee, you know, call me as you're driving, and I'll explain what's happening. Like, you don't need to bring it. Just bring your drumsticks. Drums are ready to set up. You know, they're set up, ready to go. Like, okay, all right. So I call him on the way, and he's like, listen, we, you know, something unfortunate happened, and we need you right now to come in and re-record these two songs. So I had no time to prepare. I had no time to, you know, listen or analyze any of those songs. Other than, you know, showing up at the studio, listening to the original version, and obviously in the moment, having to really pay attention to what's being played, how to tune the drums, you know, all of it. And it was like, it was in such a frenzy. I'm surprised, you know, I could even, you know, manage to do it. So, yeah, in that moment, I didn't have any time to prepare.
Wow.
I just had to sort of go in and do it.
Just jump in.
And yeah, and tuning and everything. They wanted them to sound like the originals.
Yes, as close as we could.
And if you can tell the story, great. And if you can't, that's fine too. What happened that you had to do this? You said something unfortunate happened. Did they lose the masters or something?
They couldn't find their drummer.
Okay.
That's the best way I can explain it.
Really? So, okay.
Wow. Yeah. Can I geek out real quick?
Eric, please.
Your gear, man. You got Ludwig drums, Sabian cymbals, Remo drum heads, Vic First sticks, Canopus snare wires, Warm Audio, and Mojave Audio.
Yep.
Can you tell us a little bit about Ludwig and what drew you to that company and, as versus the other companies? Because a guy like you could play anything he wants. Why Ludwig?
Well, it was the first drums that I ever owned. And, you know, everyone is going to have their sort of Ringo Starr story.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like most of the drummers that I really, really enjoyed listening to growing up, I would always see the logo Ludwig, you know, whether it was Ringo, Alex Van Halen, or, you know, John Bonham. The first endorsement I was able to get was with Mapex Drums.
Uh-huh.
They make, you know, wonderful drums. But then I found myself, you know, with, you know, when I went and purchased drums, it would always be, you know, vintage Ludwig drums or Slingerlands. And it was just more and more Ludwigs. And when I had gotten the job with Leanne Rimes, I reached out to my friend Fred Eltringham, who I knew was endorsing Ludwig, and he plays with Sheryl Crow right now. He's an incredible drummer.
Right on.
I just casually reached out to him like, hey, do you think, you know, maybe this could be an opportunity to, you know, sort of switch companies? And he was like, oh, yeah, that shouldn't be a problem at all. And he got me in touch. At the time, it was Kevin Packard, who was the A&R person over there. Artist relations. And I was able to start a relationship with them. And that was back in 2009, I think.
Nice.
And I've had a really, really wonderful relationship with them, you know, since then. And, you know, hopefully we'll continue
so forward. I think you said the correct word there, too. A great relationship, you know. And that's kind of a nice way to springboard into my next question that I'd like to ask. Recently, the group that I work with, we've had to have a sub come in on a couple of gigs due to an injury that our piano player had, and he's recuperating, getting ready to come back out with us again.
Oh.
And the one thing that we had, one guy that had, both the subs that came in were people, uh-oh, we lost Eric.
Sorry, I.
No, that's okay.
He got a call.
I wonder if it's Ringo or Billy Idol.
It's calling. Probably Billy Idol.
Sorry, one second. Let me.
No, do your thing. Do your thing. No, it's all good.
Okay. Well, hopefully he won't try to call again because I don't know who's going to interrupt a lot of
this. Well, you know what? We had Greg Bissonette on the show one day, and when he was on the show, Ringo called it, and Greg.
You better answer that.
Greg kind of goes. He goes, guys, and we're on live just like we are now. He goes, guys, I got to take this. It's Ringo, and all four of us were on the show with him, and all four of us went. I mean, we went from like grown men to 12-year-olds like that. That's what I said. I just said to Chip, I go, I wonder if that was Ringo or Billy Idol calling.
So get to your question, Bart, because okay, I got some too.
Yeah, I know you do, Chip. I know you do. So here's my question. When we had these two guys on the road with us, the common denominator that we kept talking about is how important the hang is. I think it's one thing to have great musicians around you, But if you, when you're on the road and you're living on the road and you're living in a bus, you're living in a, we hub out of an Airbnb or hotels or what have you, you got to be around these people. Nobody wants somebody around them that's just a little frantic or whatever. You know, how important is the hang? Let's talk about that, because I'm sure playing with Billy Idol, that's got to be a thing. How important, how can you be one of the guys that hangs out with the band and not freak out? I mean, how, what's that like? I think that's great advice to younger musicians.
The hang is everything. If you think about it, you know, maybe you're playing an hour or two every night.
Right.
Or in our case, you know, we might play three times a week. So you're spending, you know, way more time, you know, off stage. I mean, we were so lucky. We're so lucky that we, I mean, it does feel like a family, you know, of course, and every family, you know, have their issues and and disagreements and everything. But we're incredibly, like, I've been with Billy now for 12 years.
And he's calling again.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Don't worry about it. Okay. Yeah.
I should have put my phone on airplane mode.
That's okay.
Yeah, it's been 12 years, and, you know, we basically have, except for our keyboard player that came in a couple years later, it's been the same people. And that, you know, that says a lot.
It does.
And so, yeah, the hang is very, very important. And it's, I mean, it's one of those things where you can, maybe you can try to fit in into a situation or, you know, do all those things, you know, and at the end of the day, if it doesn't feel right or doesn't feel natural,
forced,
that will sort of reveal itself.
Yeah.
And luckily, it's just happened, you know, that I very much feel like I can be myself. And, you know, of course, they're very disturbed by my sense of humor. but they accept it. And so, I mean, what an incredible situation to be able to sort of have this job and also feel like you can be yourself 100%. And,
right.
And, you know, nothing is, you know, sure, I was pretty young when I got the job, and I definitely had my insecurities about, like, yeah, wanting to sort of fit in. And, you know, but that, everyone made that very, very comfortable from the beginning. Like, no, we picked you because it's you.
Yeah.
And that made it very, very comfortable, not only just musically, but, you know, personality wise. Sort of, you know, pretty quickly sort of found my groove within the band.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's gotten deeper and deeper. And
I think it's so important. I think that's so important. When you're in a band, I've been in the same band for 20, coming up on 26 years, and
wow.
It's just been, yeah, it's incredible. And I'm so thankful for it. And you can imagine in that amount of time, we've had people come and go and members replaced. And there are times when somebody will come in and immediately they, like you said, they try to force them their personality in, and that's tough. And I can imagine being a younger guy, and all of a sudden now you're playing with Billy Idol, and he's Billy Idol. He's obviously famous and hits and touring and playing at that upper echelon, if you will, of musicians. That has to be intimidating, and I think it would be easy for somebody to, like, not just lose it with that. And I think, and that's what Deck is all about, is trying to help other drummers and younger drummers and stuff like that avoid pitfalls. And so I think that advice that you just said is really important. I think it's really important to be able to just be yourself and hang.
Absolutely. Yeah. Eric, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, Billy made it very easy in that regard, that I think the second show I did with them, we were in Seattle, My first show was actually in Moscow. Like, it was just a one-off, a private show, flew in and out, barely even understood what was happening. But the second show, I believe, was in Seattle, and Billy took me out for, you know, martinis and oysters. And to just, you know, kind of just get to know each other a little bit. And he sort of, you know, told me his story. I told him mine. And so immediately that became super comfortable. And that was an incredible gesture that, you know, of course, made, you know, all of those things that you just mentioned, that it could be intimidating and it's him. And that sort of, what do you call it? Like, it you know, not that that it was like an escalated situation, but it just kind of brings everything down a little bit more.
To the human level, to where it's like, hey, I'm just hanging out, having a drink. Well, yeah, I'm sure at first there's still that, but the martinis and oysters, you know, we're hanging, we're having something to...
It sounds like a band name, martinis and
right,
oysters.
Right, that is a band, that's or a song title, one or the other.
I'd buy that album.
Drummers, have you ever worked with a guitar player who owns an extremely high-end acoustic guitar and they shove a pillow in the sound hole to dampen overtones? Of course not. So why would you do that to your kick drum? The Aquarian Superkick line of bass drum heads is an industry bestseller and a favorite among drummers, drum techs, and recording engineers who want a musical controlled bass drum sound without the use of blankets, pillows, or external muffling. The patented floating muffling system uses a narrow band of acoustic felt for a pre-dampened yet natural sound, eliminating unwanted high-end frequencies and boosting low-end punch. Often imitated but never duplicated, the Aquarian Superkick delivers superior tone control without all the extra work.
But anyways, Chip, you were going to ask something. Sorry, I interrupted you.
I don't want to change the subject, but I'm kind of dying to know, you know, you got this career touring, playing drums, doing your thing. In one of the interviews, I saw you talking about your sticks and explaining that it was the perfect stick for what you do with Billy Idol on tour with those big concerts, but may not even be the best stick for you when recording different types of music. And when you mentioned the recording, I thought of it at your studio, and I'm kind of curious as to how that path, you know, was there a time in your life where you decided, I don't just want to play the drums, I want to do a recording studio? And how does a young drummer go about opening his own shop? How did you do that?
Wow. Well, it certainly didn't happen overnight, or it wasn't like a straight line from point A to point B. Even growing up, like I said, I was lucky enough to have a basement, and, you know, my dad was able to put together a recording setup for me. And it started with a 4-channel cassette based Porta Studio. I don't know if you remember those.
I had one of those too. Yeah.
So I would early on sort of, even with just like one microphone, I would record myself, and I would always, you know, play along with, you know, other records to see, like, and I would sit there and like analyze my playing afterwards, and just like, oh, you know, how's your timing? How's your groove?
Reviewing,
you know,
yeah.
Right, all of that stuff. And so that sort of stayed with me. And then when I moved here, at the time, like, you know, where I was living and based on what I could afford, I kind of continued in the same trend. Like, I got a 8-channel digital recorder by Roland, and I was able to acquire a few microphones, and it sort of started there. And I'm sort of lucky in the sense that I was able to understand like how you have to really balance yourself as a drummer in the studio based on just one microphone. Because if you can sound balanced with one microphone in front of the drum kit, then you're off to a pretty good start. And so
that's a good point.
I was lucky to, you know, with every place that I moved to, I was able to, you know, purchase some more gear. And also, you know, of course, playing the drums, you have to be able to be in a facility where you can make noise.
Yeah.
And so I was, you know, able to go from like guest houses to actual houses, you know, and you know, acquire more and more gear. And so basically, you know, back to your question, like it was something that I was able to acquire based on just my own needs, but also, you know, the knowledge and the sort of the desire to be able to do this, you know, and have a full-on recording studio and you know, have that be part of my living. And right. So when I bought this house up in the mountains, like I built out a couple of different rooms and, you know, of course now I have, you know, quite a bit of gear in order to be able to accommodate all of that stuff. But, you know, like if someone wants to do something similar, like you're asking, I would say, you know, start very basic and then, you know, sort of realize what, you know, with every step that you're making, you know, what that does to the process, you know, what does that do to, you know, your ability to record well or balance yourself as a drummer, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's probably not as simple as just like waking up one day and deciding that you want to build a recording studio.
Well, it's a continued education. It's that continued education thing of always bettering yourself. You know, I mean, whether it be getting more knowledge of how to record something or acquiring a new microphone, you know, one or the other, it's always that forward progress, right?
Yeah. Speaking of microphones, Eric, on your kit tour video, you explained that you have a microphone. Not only are your in-ears connected to the drum mics, but that you also have a microphone sitting behind your stool. What's the purpose of that, and can you explain why you would do that?
Yeah, I mean, that is... It's basically like, you know, when you're in the studio and you have room microphones to sort of pick up the overall sound of the drum kit, not just like individual mics on each drum that can sound pretty, you know, separated and weird, I guess. And so, you know, one day I just kind of like had the idea of like, hey, why don't I just put a microphone that sort of acts as a room mic for the stage, and utilizing a little bit of compression and EQ to kind of just make it sound exciting, just the same way that you would do in the studio with a room mic. Mm-hmm.
So that gives you more of a overall big picture view of what the sound is happening.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, I messed around with the placement quite a bit and the height and, you know, sort of where it was pointing, because it's a SM57, so it's very directional. So, you know, I think at first I tried it more over by the floor tom, and that kind of, you know, took over the low frequencies a little bit too much. And then over on the hi-hat side, and that got a little too bright. So it kind of made sense to have it behind me, because then I also sort of acted as a buffer for some of the high frequencies to come through. And then what happened was I loved the sound of it so much that everyone else in the band actually ended up, you know, using a little bit of that microphone, because it just, again, it just gave it a sort of a sonic cohesive picture of the whole drum kit, not as, you know, individual.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So do you guys run
that's how that came about.
Do you guys run your own ears on stage or no?
No, we have a dedicated monitor engineer.
Okay. Yeah, I've run my own ears. I'm anal about my drum sound, so I was just curious about that. In your studio, do you use Logic, Pro Tools?
Yeah. Pro Tools.
You do use Pro Tools. Okay, cool. That's awesome. Yeah. And I was watching some of the videos that on the website, people in there recording. You have a lot of clients that come up from LA to record, and they're, you know, if you're recording an album, that's obviously longer than one trip. Do they get a room up there and stay up there, or how does that work out for them? They make a trip up and down the hill every day?
No, I mean, I can facilitate some housing here, especially if I know the people. There's a couple of Airbnbs nearby that I normally rent out for bands.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, it's, you know, the whole purpose was sort of to have it be like a destination recording, like a retreat almost.
Yeah.
Where people can, you know, get out of the city. And again, because it's so, I mean, again, like an hour and a half, you know, if you're from the west side or whatever, it's a little bit longer. But the fact that it's so different, you know, mm-hmm. and that you're yeah. away from all the noise and all the people, and you come up here and you can just sort of get in a very different, well, hopefully, get in a different, you know, creative headspace.
That's what I was just going to say. I'm sure it's a very creative thing, even if you have a band coming up to record songs that are already written or, you know, song forms together, everything. We just got to go lay it down. I'm sure that getting up there gets the creative juices flowing and will enhance even songs like that.
Well, yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, it's really about the environment that you provide.
And yeah.
I'm lucky to have the environment outside to be very sort of creative, peaceful. You know, nature has a way of sort of grounding all of us, right?
Right.
And when it comes to doing something creative, it seems to be very much enhanced by nature. You know, there's a reason why you have these retreats. And but even just inside of my studio here, like, you need to create an environment that's comfortable for people. And so, you know, the sort of the best compliments that I can sort of experience is that, you know, whenever people show up here, they just sit down and grab, you know, they sit down at my piano, or they, you know, grab a guitar, or like, it seems that when people show up here, they feel inspired.
That's really
the goal. Because, yeah. you know, I'm so sure, you know, we've all been in, you know, the top studios in Hollywood, where you walk into what could be perceived as a very intimidating environment. You know, you show up, there's a big shiny SSL console, tons of microphones and outboard gear, and a big empty room. And it may not be the most comfortable situation and most inspiring.
Yeah.
Like, if you're intimidated, like you know, there's different levels of being sort of under the gun, where, you know, some intimidation and some stress could actually be positive for you. But in general, I think people want to be comfortable.
Yeah.
And so I try to be very mindful. Like, my wife, she comes down here and she's like, oh my God, how can you even live like this? Because I create what I call an organized mess, where like all the instruments are kind of ready to go. You know, every instrument has their sort of dedicated microphone, mic pre, compressor, EQ, whatever it might be. But the whole idea is just that everything is available. Like, even all my cables, I have this insane wall of cables. You know, ranging from, you know, XLR to, you know, TRS to, you know, USB. Because, you know, at a moment's notice, if someone needs to do something, I need to be able to, you know, reach for it and go. You know, like, I don't want to ever be that person that hinders, you know, the creative process. If someone gets inspired to do something, I want to be able to go, give me 30 seconds and, you know, you'll be up and running, you know.
Yeah. What about the drums? Do you have a house kit, or do people bring in their own kits? How does that work? Because I know it's a geek out question.
People might bring their own snare drums and maybe some cymbals, and I encourage that if it's something that, you know, they feel comfortable with. But no, I have probably three different kits here, you know, that are quickly interchangeable.
How big's your drum room? Where you track them?
You know what?
I might be able to. Oh, cool. I got it. Now I'm going to geek out. I got to see this. This is. I'm at home now. Oh,
there
look
you go.
At that.
Can you see it?
Yeah, that's gorgeous.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So that's a secondary kit, where I call it my trash kit, where I just kind of mic up, usually just with one ribbon mic.
Right.
So How big is this? About 25 by 20, I think.
That's beautiful. Yeah, that's awesome. And you know,
I love the aesthetic.
What's this?
This is a separate room for amps and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Perfect.
I could stick a singer in there if I wanted to because there's a window. But,
What? Go ahead. Please put the singer in there and lock the door, would you?
Yeah, just don't let him have the tambourine.
Yeah, don't give him a tambourine. Please don't give him a tambourine or
a cowbell.
My God, yeah. You man. See, no wonder you got the job with Billy Idol. You're smart, too.
So, you can hopefully in and out of focus.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. No, that's beautiful.
So, yeah, that's the crazy cable wall.
Oh, yeah. That's not that crazy. That's awesome. That's beautiful.
Twin Pines Recording. This is the place you're looking to escape city life and find peaceful, inspiring vibes to fuel your next recording. Eric's studio is set up in such a way that you forget about time, outside pressures, and just get lost in the passion of making music.
God, that is gorgeous, buddy. Congratulations on that. That's really cool, man.
Yeah,
that's
man.
Really cool.
Thank you for that pitch, Chip.
So when, you know
that's
what?
That's hopefully the case.
Yeah, when somebody comes up, do you also produce, or are you strictly an engineer when they record their CDs?
No, I do a lot of producing as well.
Oh, okay.
Do you mix there?
I do.
And master?
I don't master. I have my guy, Dave Donnelly, that does all the mastering. Yeah.
Cool.
Mixing is... I enjoy it if I know that I sort of... It's usually related to, like, if it's something that I've been producing and sort of been part of the whole... I'm part of the every step of the way, then I feel comfortable mixing because I know exactly what I'm going for.
Right.
But I generally don't look for those jobs in terms of advertising myself as a mix engineer.
Yeah, that's good. That would be that. That's a rough gig. I can, you get something in and here, mix this for me, and you just got a bunch of stems. It's like, well, what are you looking for?
It can be intimidating.
And
I mean, I do it every now and again, but then it kind of has to be, like I said, it has to be something that really connects with me and resonates, sonically, that like, okay, I know that I can, make this right for you.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I have, a long list of people that could do a much better job than me. But producing, I do love engineering. I mean, the recording process is very, very exciting to me.
That's always, I love getting in the studio. Like, I'll sit in here sometimes and I do a lot of stuff for sync licensing, or I try to do stuff for sync licensing. Mm-hmm. I've got a few things placed. And sometimes just sitting down and, okay, I don't know what I'm going to record, but I'm going to record something at the kit, and then building off of that is, there's something magical about it, when it's that organic. I love that. I have to ask, what did you work with Michael Blum? What did you record with him? Or were you a session drummer, or did you do any albums? Or?
So there's this Swedish actor named Peter Stormare?
Peter Stormare, yeah. Yeah, I might have... You and I know we walked through a door or passed each other at one time then, because I was there when he was doing some of those sessions. Like, I was just coming in and out. He was finishing something up. And, yeah, anyway, sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
No, that's... I was introduced to Peter. He's become a friend, obviously. A bass player named Johnny Griparek, who's also Swedish. I don't know if you met him during your stints over there, but so Peter, Johnny, and myself did a few records together, and most of it would take place at Mike's place. And then I know that Peter kind of partnered up with him and did a lot more work there, you know, that I wasn't necessarily part of. But
now here, talk about 6 degrees of separation. I'm going to call, after we get off the interview, after the podcast, I'm going to call my buddy. I play with the guy I play with is Sam Morrison from the Sam Morrison Band. And I know he recorded some guitar solos or recorded a guitar part on something of Peter's. So I wonder if you and Sam are on a song together. I'm going to do you ever remember meeting Sam? Sam did a lot of the vocal work for him on some of that on a lot of that sync licensing stuff. Like, I don't know if did you ever hear any of the Meatloaf stuff that he did for the sync licensing things or the Bob Seger stuff?
I don't. I mean, it was sort of after I was there quite a bit that, you know, I knew that he had gotten it because I, you know, last time I saw him, he said that the majority of the business for him was exactly that, you know, sync stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't really do any of that stuff with him. My stuff that I did with Michael was through Peter.
That's really cool. I've got to ask Sam about the stuff with Peter. That would be cool if you guys played on a song or something together.
Yeah, it's very possible.
A recording. It's very possible. That's really cool. That's awesome.
Hey, Eric.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say we got dates on the Billy Idol's website, the tour dates. We'll put a link in the comments so people can check out your tour dates. You're not playing right now at this moment. You're not on tour. When you're getting ready to go on tour, do you have a process? Do you start playing drums more, or do you have like a, or do you always stay on the drums, or how does that work for getting ready to go on tour with Billy Idol?
Well, I mean, I stay pretty active, obviously with doing sessions and things like that when we're not touring. But yeah, when, you know, a couple of weeks before each tour, I definitely, you know, I definitely spend a little bit more time practicing, definitely spend a little bit more time in the gym. just again, it's very different, you know, sitting by yourself, even playing along, you know, with the songs versus, you know, being on stage with the guys. You know, it's a different level of energy, of course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I might look
like
an
insane
person.
He's got these insane stick heights and beats the hell out of the snare, man. It's crazy cool.
That's awesome.
It's it feels a little bit silly sometimes when I sit here and practice by myself before a tour because you kind of have to, you know, perform. You know, there's no one that I'm performing for here other than myself maybe, but so no, like it's, you just have to get, you know, you have to, it's mainly physically, you know, physically you just have to be prepared. So you don't go out there and, you know, pull your shoulder or your neck or whatever it might be, because as you both know, adrenaline kicks in and, you know, you get excited and there's a big crowd or whatever, even just like playing with the rest of the guys gives you, you know, a boost of adrenaline. And if you're not ready, you could hurt yourself.
Yeah,
and
James.
So, you know, my, you know, forearms and shoulders and things like that are definitely, you know, taking a beating. So I try to do as much as I can, whether it's working out, stretching, getting a few massages, you know, yoga, hot baths, you know, like I keep, you know, the guys in the band make fun of me because I pretty much, as much as I can, I will soak myself in a hot bath or in a sauna. I'll sit in a sauna or a steam room as often as I can.
Nice. James B. Harrison, a friend of ours, thanks for watching, James. He asks, do you play harder with Billy versus studio drumming? And I think you answered that. I guess the answer is yes.
Yeah. Again, if something is required in the studio where, you know, obviously, you know, I do records, you know, that are more, you know, aggressive and things like that. But in the studio in general, you know, you don't have to hit as hard because you can achieve that with microphones and mic pre and compressors. And a lot of the times like the old misconception about John Bonham is that you can get a bigger and, you know, fatter sound if you don't hit as hard. Because technically you do choke the heads. And it's not just on drums. It's on any instrument. Like you strum an acoustic guitar, you hit the piano really hard. And when you, you know, really get used to recording all these different instruments, you do understand that, you know, there's a certain resonance and certain you know, largeness that you can achieve from an instrument by letting, you know, the body, you know, especially, you know, when it comes to acoustic instruments like drums, obviously that's an acoustic instrument, an acoustic guitar, an acoustic piano. All these things resonate, right?
Yeah.
So that's what you have to keep in mind. Like, let the instruments do the job for you. You know what I mean? Don't, there's no need to beat it to hell to sound big. Nice. So that's the sort of dichotomy that maybe people don't understand until they really get into sort of this side of the business, if you want to call it that,
right,
you know, the recording aspect.
There's a video, there's a shot of Bonham. You mentioned Bonham right before the Nebenwerth, or at the beginning of the Nebenwerth concert, which I believe was the last concert that they did before he passed. And it starts with rock and roll, of course. And the camera is like right, it's right there. It's right there, you know. And one, two, three. I mean, he's really low. He's not beating the hell out of the drum. You know, it's really low. He's got great, great, great technique. And one of the things, too, you talked about choking out the instrument or choking out the drums. One of the things that Dom Famularo used to talk about, you know, if you hold the sticks real tight or real loose, it's a cavernous difference in the sound of the sticks. That's definitely going to, you know, that's going to transform or transcend into the drums, into the cymbals, and into the mics. The mics are going to pick that up, you know. So being relaxed, I think there's a lot that goes into being a session player that people don't realize until you get there and you start doing it.
That's great, man. That's good stuff. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Eric. I really appreciate it, man. This has been awesome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's fantastic.
Yeah, Eric, thank you so much, man. We really appreciate you coming on the show. We try to keep it at an hour. We've gone a few minutes over, but that's okay.
Wow, an hour flew by. Wow.
Right? You know, I would love to pick your brain all day long about session work. I sit in this room all day long and create. And just I love it. So I would love to invite you back on the show.
I think that sounds like an opportunity to book a consultation with Eric.
I think I should. Hypothetically,
come up to the mountains, man.
Dude, I would love to come up. I would.
Yeah, me too, man.
I would love to invite you back onto the show again. Maybe we do this show every once in a while. We just call it a round table. And what we do is we pick a subject matter and we talk about it. And I know Jeremy, the host that's not here today, he's done some recording at Skywalker Studios. And just some amazing stuff. So maybe we could do a round table on session work and have you back on. And we'd love to have you back on the
that'd be great.
Have you back on. Yeah, okay, great. Everybody, thank you for watching and listening to Deck. We greatly appreciate it. And if we took you away an extra 6 minutes, thanks for sticking in there with us and listening and watching and doing whatever you do. Next week, I think Rick and Jeremy will be – well, no, Jeremy's going to be over in Europe. He sent me some videos and pictures this morning. I'm very jealous. I wish I was over there with him. But anyway, we'll see you next week. Eric, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm going to try to hit the end button and play something that is smart before it ends. So – I'm not promising anything. Anybody, thank you for watching Deck and listening to Deck. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks a lot.